This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Allison Benedict.
And I'm Dan Kois.
Dan, what's the worst parenting fail you've admitted to on Slate's parenting podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting?
Probably the time the Tooth Fairy completely forgot to visit.
Join us for expert interviews, parenting triumphs and fails, and straight talk about raising kids from age zero to finally out of the house.
Just search for Slate Mom and Dad Are Fighting in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app.
The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/xx.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, March 20th, the Stranger Danger edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor at XX. I am joined today by Jessica Winter, a senior editor for Slate. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure, we're delighted to have you. June is on vacation. She said she wanted me to tell everyone that she is in the UK eating spotted dick. That's what her message said. So I'm just, you know, I'm just the messenger. And then Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
Before we begin, a couple of announcements. One is that we have our email set up, xxgabfest@slate.com. We've already gotten some wonderful responses from some of you, but keep them coming. This is a great place to tell us things you want us to talk about or just send comments on the show. Our best one this week came from one Stephen Noble, who listened to our live show last week. The email was titled Hurt Short Man. And what he said was, what bothered me was when a man was quoted as saying he liked women who are thin, that got an immediate ugh from the crowd. But that women are allowed to say they only like men who are tall, and nobody thinks that's a problem. So that was a good point. I thought that was a nice hypocrisy on the part of us women that I hadn't noticed. Don't you think, guys? It might have even been you, Noreen, who said that about tall men.
Oh, no.
I don't think I would have said that out loud.
Right. Someone read your mind.
Keep them to yourself. But I do remember someone's. No, I think it was in our dating lab section where people talked about tall men and short men and nobody gave it a second thought. So you are right. We will be more sensitive to the short men. My second quick announcement, I think you guys have realized this by now, but the other Slate podcast, the parenting one, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, is no longer on the XX feed. People who were not parents thought that those feeds should be separated, and they now are. So we heard you and it's done. Okay, our three topics for today. First, should you let your kids do dangerous things? A new cover story in The Atlantic by one Hannah Rosen says we've gone way overboard in protecting our children and we should let them do dangerous things. Is Hannah Rosen crazy? Second, I've never done an introduction of one of my own pieces. Like, I have this double life as like the Slate and the Atlantic person.
Well,
so.
Speaking about yourself in the third person is a good way to prove the is Hannah Rosen.
Is Hannah Rosen crazy? At least weird, if not crazy. I should have let one of you do the introduction anyway. Second, taking that argument to the online world, a new book called It's Complicated by researcher Dana Boyd argues that we should let kids roam more free on the internet. Is that also a crazy idea? And finally, we will talk about Scarlett Johansson. An over-the-top profile in The New Yorker tells us more about how male writers sometimes react to a sexy subject than it tells us about the sexy subject herself. Okay, I am now going to continue the weirdness by doing the introduction for my own story, The Atlantic, and then how about one of you asks me a question and then it will become more normal. rather than me ask myself a question. Okay, a brief summary of my story in The Atlantic. I'll try and make it less weird. In the fall, I took my young son to something called an adventure playground, or a junk playground, in North Wales. This is a place where kids play with old tires, they stack loose wooden pallets, and they make fires. Yes, they make fires on their own with matches and firewood in the corner. Their parents are nowhere in sight. I hardly saw a single parent the whole all the time that I was there, which was 2 or 3 days. When I came back and showed pictures and videos to my friends, they all said that this place seemed insane. So what I concluded from that experience and lots of other research was that we Americans are way too preoccupied with keeping our children safe from both physical and emotional harm. The result is that in one generation, we've stripped childhood of a lot of independence and discovery and, down the road, the courage to take risks. So that's my argument. Somebody argue with me.
Well,
I'm wrong.
First, I have a question, which is, how did it get to be this way and when did it happen?
So this was what was interesting for me. I think for parents of my age, we have this nostalgic sense that our childhood was very different than the childhood our children are living. And sometimes, as I wrote in the story, I think I might be making it up. Like, is it really true that I roamed the streets and that my mother paid no attention to me all weekend? Is that possible, given the way that I raise my children now? Like, she didn't really drive me many places. I mean, okay, I took a ballet class here and there. I took horseback. I remember a few things that my mother did here and there. But there was not the sense that I was always being tended to and watched and my schedule was being managed. So that was the impetus for looking into the story. Like, how did things actually change? I wanted to see if my memories matched up with statistics. And in fact, it's true. Like, if you look at, there are sort of large sociological studies showing that in the 70s, for example, 80% of third graders walked to school by themselves. To let a third grader walk to a school by him or herself would be considered nuts. Like, nobody does it. And the big change happened between the 70s and the 90s when I think some kind of fear, moral panic, stranger danger kind of took hold of us. And now it's something like 5%. I mean, that's a big difference in one generation.
Whoa, yeah.
So it went down to 9% in the 90s and it's dropped even further now. And so you got to think, how did that happen? And I think there just came to be this panic that strangers were going to steal your children, that playgrounds were dangerous places. I think that we didn't realize what was going on as it was going on, but actually what was going on is that public spaces became to seem dangerous. Like, we somehow thought of the public space as a sort of threat to our children and the private home as the only place where they could safely be. So what's called free range, meaning the range the children are allowed to roam starting from their house, just got really, really limited over the years.
And in your piece, you say, you know, when my daughter was 10 years old, we realized she hadn't been unsupervised for even, you know, 10 minutes, we thought. Does that mean even within your, like, if she's in the backyard, are you in the backyard or when
she's
younger?
Well, we don't really have a backyard, but she's not, like, being watched by somebody. So that's to say she's either in school or she's with her babysitter or she's with us. So she could be playing up in her room. It doesn't mean, like, I'm eyeballing her
right.
all the time.
Okay.
That would be, like, super weird, but as opposed to just slightly weird. But where she knew that she was being, that an adult was in charge of her. Like, I give the example. Okay, so my example, Noreen being much younger than me and Jessica being younger than me, or maybe much younger than me. I know how old Noreen is because I podcast with her all the time. But
I am nestled comfortably in between you.
Good. Excellent. Nestling comfortably. So, The memory that I describe of my childhood, which is this, and you guys tell me if this is anything like your childhoods. So I tell the story of my friend Kim and I when we were 9 playing cops and robbers, which is something I did a lot. I grew up in Queens, so I grew up in a bunch of apartment buildings. And we locked up these younger kids in jail because we were the cops and they were the robbers. And then we forgot about them and went off to Alba's Pizzeria, you know, to go get a pizza and an ices with my dollar. And then I came back and they were still there and they were pretty upset. But, like, nobody came to rescue them. Like, the idea that a parent would come and fix that situation was not it wasn't how it happened. It was kind of a, and it's, I purposely chose a story that wasn't like, you know, sunshine and roses. Like, this isn't right. a great story, right? Like, the kids probably felt bullied and intimidated, and like Kim and I were the queens and we were going to lock them up and they had to listen to us. I mean, it's not a great story, but it really is what I remember childhood like. And there was no thought that a parent was going to show up and rescue anybody.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a suburb of Buffalo in the 80s, and, you know, we were always running around, riding our bikes without a helmet, all hours and hours of unsupervised time. So that rings true to me as well. The opening of your piece, where you're describing these feral children scampering around this post-apocalyptic landscape that is the adventure playground. So I read it aloud to my husband, Adrian, who is in his 40s. He grew up in rural Suffolk. In England in the 70s and 80s. So he grew up in the home of the adventure playground, which you talk about in your piece. There was a lot of them in London. And he didn't have an adventure playground growing up, but he did grow up next to all these derelict cottages, and it was basically like a bomb site while they were redeveloping it. Mm-hmm. And your piece unfurled this whole skein of memories for him because it was this Mad Max wonderland for him and his friends. You know, they would be running around the second floor of one of these cottages and the floor would give way and then you'd be on the first floor and you could reconfigure the houses how you wanted because there were all these bricks and window parts laying around. You know, you could knock down the walls, you could make new rooms. And he said that the best part was that there was all this combustible material so you could make these cool fires like the kids do in your piece. And they would find tins of paint and they would throw the tins of paint on the fire so the pressure would make it explode. But then all the fumes would create these fireballs. These are 9-year-old kids. Like,
wow.
Crazy. And so I said, okay, I have two questions. One, was there ever a parent anywhere near you? And he said, no, of course not. And I said, okay, number two, what did you think of the adventure playgrounds? And he said, eh, they were kind of lame, but they were probably cool if you lived in the city.
Right.
So the country kids were kind of turning up their nose at these, you know, fancy adventure playgrounds. So it's all relative. But I guess I'm like Noreen, I'm confused about how in the space of like a generation or a generation and a half, we've gotten so far away from this ideal because it is within our memories, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And me too. Like I think my childhood was somewhat like Jessica's, like suburbs of Cleveland. You know, we were a lot, there were some woods, not large woods, like a private boys' school 2 blocks from us. We were allowed to just like go play in those woods whenever we wanted. And like, you know, that, I mean, I probably, if I had kids and they were like, I'm going to just go hang out in those woods by the private boys' school for hours and hours, I probably wouldn't say yes, but it was fine. And it was like some of the most creative play of my childhood.
Yeah.
What did you guys do in the woods with the boys?
In the woods? That was later.
Actually, I'm going to answer the question as best I can. But first, I want to know about Adrian. What class is he? Like, what social class did he grow up?
His parents were kind of working class, rural. You know, they started out rural poor and they kind of made it to rural working class.
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting story because, in fact, they were founded because of bomb sites. That
right.
People saw how kids were playing on bomb sites and thought that urban playgrounds were so super lame, and that they were going to create something which looked like a bomb site. Because in, you know, around World War II, I mean, in that era when adventure playgrounds were more common or were just starting to rise up in the UK, they were concurrent with the values of that generation. You know, kids have to be reckless and brave and courageous and learn how to handle risks on their own. It's only now that they seem so out of sync with parenting norms and so odd. Okay, so let's dig in deeper about what happened. So what actually happened is that the old way that communities and neighborhoods function fell apart, partly because of what happened to families, basically. Mothers work, so there aren't as many mothers around. And there was a huge divorce boom in the 70s, so there wasn't quite the sense of community that there used to be, a sense that there was kind of a whole fabric of a neighborhood kind of taking care of your child. Because when I say that my mother didn't watch me, my specific mother didn't watch me, but there were a lot of moms around
right.
in the park or somewhere or walking down the street or doing errands, and there was a sense that they all knew me. Like, maybe my mother in the back of her mind thought that, like, if I was getting into a fight in the handball courts, which is what we – this is the trouble we would get into in Queens, somebody would see me. Like, someone's mom would come and tell her or knock on the door or something like that, even though – so she didn't really feel the need to look over me. But I think then those fears are very hard to grasp. They're very vague. Like, nobody thinks, like, oh, there's a community breakdown and I'm feeling nervous about that. So what we did is, like, localize these fears into stranger danger, into a sense that there were predators lurking. And I talk about two specific cases. Like, one is a case where a kid smashed his head on a playground. And the other case is the Eitan Potts case of a kid who got abducted. Mm-hmm. In the 1979, I remember this case from when I was a kid, and then that was the first memory I have of the moral panic taking hold. The New York Times running stories saying that kids were being abducted by sexual predators. Now, mind you, we had no idea what happened to Eitan Potts for decades after. There was no notion that he had been abducted by a sexual predator. We had no idea what happened to him, and yet this is the way we started to talk about it. And as I write in the story, the reason this fear is misplaced is because you have no more danger now of a random horrible abduction than you did then. Like, that is an extremely freakishly rare occurrence, and it's not more common now. So there's no reason we should tell our children not to talk to strangers. Like, that admonition has done far more harm than good.
But is there any way of addressing that in a vacuum? Like, if my fabulous neighbors down the hall in my building in Brooklyn decided that their 7-year-old was old enough and responsible enough to, you know, take her house key and go down the street to the bodega to get, you know, milk and toilet paper and come back. You know, in a perfect world, that would be seen as a totally reasonable and good skill-building, confidence-building exercise for her, and she'd be perfectly safe because we are in a neighborhood where a lot of people know each other. But the social stigma at this point of making that very reasonable decision is so great and so risky that I wonder if you could ever do it without having, I don't know, people calling social services on you or something.
Yeah, that's the problem. I do it sometimes, and particularly after reading the story. Like, I've only got one child left to not ruin, which is the child who's in the story, who's, you know, only 5. But I did it this morning. I'm trying to systematically – he's only in kindergarten. He walks to school with his friend who's in first grade. And I'm trying to teach them now how to cross streets and go across alleys so that by the time they're in third grade, they can walk to school by themselves. Now, it will be seen as deranged. I realize that. But I think it would be better at a school level. Like, the one example that a lot of people point out is this school in New Zealand that suspended all the playground rules. It's an experiment that's written about quite a lot. It's been going on for a couple of years. It was done in collaboration with these local academics, and it's been a fabulous success. You know, so they stopped telling kids not to do this and not to run and not to go up the hill. Mm. And so basically they operate like 1970s kids, and it's been really, really successful. And so you would have to have something like a massive school effort to, you know, like, let children walk by themselves. Like, there are packs of children who walk to the middle school from my neighborhood, but there's always a parent who accompanies them for no reason. Like, there doesn't need to be a parent who accompanies them, except for the fact that it's socially unacceptable.
Can I add one more theory as to why it changed?
Yes.
Which is that people have fewer kids than they used to. Mm-hmm. And so my family's a little bit of a throwback. There were a bunch of us. There were 6 of us. And so I walked to the store at an early age, but I was with, you know, my 14-year-old brother or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's not – and so that was sort of, you know, in the 50s or 60s or even 70s, families with even 3 or more kids were more common. And so then that became the norm. There were just, you know, first of all, your older kid – the older kids in your family were, like, taking care of you a little bit, like, somewhere in between – a parent and a child, you know, so it still felt like they were within the space of childhood, but they were a little bit more responsible, and it was good for them to feel more responsible. And it's not that, you know, if there's 2 kids in a family, it's not that that dynamic doesn't exist. But I do think that, like, sometimes, you know, if you see someone who has one child, they focus a lot of energy on that one child. And, you know, that can extend to safety. Like, why would you let that child be alone in the world when you could take care of it? Whereas, you know, if you have a few more kids, your attention, it's a little more divided.
Right. My favorite research that I came across in doing this story was by this guy, Roger Hart, who had in 1972 followed all the children in this Vermont town and written a dissertation called The Geography of Childhood, in which he mapped how far children could roam. And he made all these videos because mm-hmm. they did a BBC documentary. He's British, although it was an American town. And it was like a lot of it was about pack mentality. Mm-hmm. Like, kids roamed in packs. There really was no sense that you only were with kids your own age. There was always some little brother hanging around, or, you know, kids of slightly different ages would organize themselves into baseball teams or whatever. It's like a world that I forgot about. I mean, it's a child culture, basically. And that was one of the conclusions I made in the story, is that that child culture, with all its rules, like, one of the rules was that, you know, children vaguely look out for each other and make up their own hierarchies, is basically doesn't exist anymore. But it was really interesting to see it on film, because I largely, like I said, I thought maybe I had made it up. Okay, well, you can read my story on the Atlantic website. It should be up today on www.atlantic.com. Sorry, Slate, I'm being a traitor here. Okay, so let's move on to our second topic, which is kids exploring the online world. But before I do that, I want to thank our loyal sponsor, Audible.com. Audible offers over 150,000 audiobooks, as well as any form of chatter available on the internet, and you can listen to them on any device, including the one you're using to listen to us right now. For XX listeners who aren't Audible members, you can get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at our special URL, audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, but XX. The book I'm going to recommend this week is the book that we are about to discuss, which is called It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens by Dana Boyd. And if you sign up, your membership also includes a free subscription to either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. So give it a try today, audiblepodcast.com/XX. Okay, easy transition to Dana Boyd. For many years, researcher Dana Boyd has been studying the online lives of teens. Now she has a new book out called It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens. In it, Boyd elaborates on her argument that parents are too restrictive of their children's wanderings online and worried about all the wrong things. Just like in the physical world, we believe that sexual predators are lurking everywhere online and that teenagers are too naive to navigate safely, even though no data really backs up that fear. As a result, we fail to recognize actual vulnerability when it comes upon us. So the thing I was most interested in is this suburban girl named Sabrina. Do you guys remember this girl in the Dana Boyd chapter? We will include a link to her chapter on our show page. I'm just going to read a quote from Sabrina, and you guys tell me if it sounds like Sabrina is a typical teenager or an exaggeration of a typical teenager. She says to Dana Boyd, who has visited her in this Texas suburb, "Any person could be a 40-year-old man waiting to come and rape me or something. I'm really meticulous about that because I've heard basically my whole life, don't talk to people you don't know online because they'll come and kill you."
But Sabrina was a bit of an outlier, right? Sabrina was more afraid of that than most of the teenagers that Dana Boyd talked to, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, I, being not a digital native myself, like, I don't, you know, teach my daughter that people are going to come kill her on the internet. Maybe I should. And I wonder if you grew up thinking, like, that the internet was a dangerous place.
Well, okay. So I was a teenager in the 90s, basically, like 90s and early 2000s. And so my parents were very strict about my online usage. Like, I got in trouble because I had set up a secret, you know, AIM name and AOL account for myself that I only used to email my friends from school. But all of my friends, not all of my friends, but like a lot of people my age were going on message boards. Like, it was that era where, like, message boards were a thing, and they were sort of flirting with, like, random people who could have been whoever. No one ever met up with those people. Like, nothing really ever came out of it, but it was a thing that happened a lot. But my sense of the internet is that that has changed, and that teens sort of mostly want to interact with each other now, right? Like, because everyone's online. I think at that time, the people who were in message boards were teenagers who were exploring the world in this way, and maybe people who were hiding from the world maybe a little bit. Mm-hmm. But now everyone's online, and you can sort of find, you know, you can find the digital schoolyard that you want to be in.
So why has that changed? Because I have no sense at all that my daughter is interacting with anybody she doesn't know. She is online a lot, but it seems to me it's you know, 98%. Now, of course, she's in her room, sometimes with the door closed, so I'm not pretending I know everything that's going on. But it does seem to me that she is largely just sending goofy emails to her friends and posting goofy pictures and doing goofy things.
Because that's what people – well, first of all, because everyone's online now, so your online space is going to mirror your real life space for the most part. But, like, that is sort of what you want to do as a teenager, I think. I mean, it's, at least it's what I wanted to do. I didn't really have this impulse to, like, go on weird message boards. A lot of people did. I don't know why I didn't. But I think, like, I just think you – when you're a teenager, you're interested in your friends mostly. And you're interested in what, like, the gossip is in eighth grade.
You know, in order to prepare for this segment, I reread that fantastic Rolling Stone story from 2011 about Kiki Cannibal. Do you guys remember this story?
No,
about
I don't
Kiki Cannibal,
that.
The girl who played with fire. It's a story about a girl who – the reason I love this story is because one distinction Dana Boyd makes is between girls like Sabrina, basically, you know, protected suburban girls, and girls who are kind of vulnerable for some family reason. Either, you know, they're neglected or their family's very permissive, and they end up in these kind of flirtatious situations with people, and it all kind of gets out of control, you know. So Kiki became this – it was a MySpace sensation at the time, and it just – like people started to hate on her. And there's this amazing video that she makes where she dances to Mr. Roboto in her like in sort of a cat suit. And the thing that was really moving to me is like the combination of kind of flaunting sexiness, but then clearly not being really kind of naive and goofy about it. Like all those things were sort of in that teenage mix, and yet she couldn't hold on to it. Like she couldn't sort of control it in the way that she wanted to. So it got totally out of control. So Noreen, when you were saying...
Wait, what happened to Kiki though? Did she come to a bad end?
Yes. I mean, she had to leave her house. She did not die, but she got sort of involved with this guy who, again, was 18. It's like what Dana Boyd says. You know, the guy was not 40. Like, we all think it's these sort of like old pedophiles, but it turns out it can be just someone slightly older than you are. Like, he said he was 17. Turned out he was 18, you know, and they did then have a real world relationship. And he ended up basically living in her house. And he was like a lunatic. I think he killed himself, actually, at some point. But he was pretty deranged. And people started like, you know, spray painting slut on her front lawn. And they basically had to move. And she had to, you know, pick up and start a new life. But watching that Mr. Roboto video of her, like, sort of, you know, just kind of goofy sexiness and just seeing how everyone could see that and just hate on her or think all the wrong things about her. So when you said, Noreen, that people would just flirt with guys online, I just wonder, like, you know, they probably are just doing something that is reasonable and innocent and part of growing up, and yet it could get out of control.
Yeah, and luckily it largely didn't. I mean, one thing I was thinking about just as you were talking is that the internet 10 years ago, people mostly had pseudonyms. And I think something that adds a degree of comfort for a lot of people now is that with most social networking sites, people are using their real names and it's linked to their real identity and it's linked to their real life social network in a meaningful way. So, you know, if someone, I mean, this is for a slightly older age group than we're talking about, but like, let's say college kids are meeting people on Tinder or whatever, they are able to see like who that person actually is. And so while it might not be the safest thing in the world to go in, on a date with a stranger from the internet, like you have a way of tracing it if you want to.
Also, right. But I think an interesting counterpoint to that is that Dana Boyd has also written or talked about how, you know, pseudonymous versus using your real name doesn't, it's not necessarily operative for kids online because kids online want to be different people in different spaces. So they go to Instagram to fulfill one part of themselves. They go to Twitter for another. They're not kind of wandering away from Facebook so much as their interests are just diversifying and they can become different people in different spaces. I also, sort of related to the Kiki Cannibal story was I thought one of the very compelling stories that Dana Boyd tells is about Tess, who was known as the MySpace killer or something like that, or the MySpace girl. And she killed her mother, or she and her boyfriend killed her mother. And the news reports sort of implicitly attributed it to MySpace, that she was on MySpace and therefore by a transitive property she killed her mother. Where actually no, I mean it was really like that. And where actually, you know, if her teachers or if anyone who was looking out for her had been attuned to what she was saying and doing on MySpace, they would have seen that for a year and a half she was leaving a record of the abuse and the terror that she was experiencing in her home, and they could have helped her. So, you know, MySpace did not cause a death. MySpace could have actually prevented a death and prevented abuse if MySpace, for example, hadn't been blocked in her school.
Right. And people, and in fact, you know, Dana Boyd reached out to a friend of hers, right, and started talking to a friend of hers and figuring out what was going on. And, you know, she basically used Tess's MySpace account as a way to do reporting.
Right.
Yeah, and then there was the case of those other two girls who disappeared. She does pick a lot of great stories. I mean, all the stories, it's interesting, Noreen, the stories that she picks are from 2007, 2008, and I do wonder if we've just learned a lot more since then.
Yeah, I mean, I think the internet moves really quickly. I think this is sort of my larger question about the whole essay. I guess it's a book. I've only read the excerpt that's on Medium. But she starts from a place of saying, you know, we are in a moral panic over the internet. It's the same thing that happens every time there is something new that, like, kids are into. Everyone felt this way about Elvis Presley shaking his hips. They felt this way about television. You know, the internet is just the latest thing that old people don't understand. And people, in this case, it's people are afraid that girls are going to get abducted or whatever. I actually don't think that's the main moral panic over the internet right now. And I think it's more like we are worried about both adults and children about the way the internet is reshaping our brains. I think that's part of it. And I also think, like, with kids specifically, I think the moral panic is maybe now more over bullying, which is a slightly different thing. I mean, she talks a little bit about bullying, and I'm sure there's more of it in her book. But at least for me, the thing that I panic about with the internet, and, you know, I don't have kids, but if I do someday, like, I would be worried about the fact that they could, you know, pull up porn when they were seven, and they could just, you know, that they would only text with their friends and not talk to them face to face. Like, I do think that reshapes your brain. I think it's reshaped my brain. And so maybe I'm just an old person having a moral panic. But I feel like she sort of cherry picked with the example of, like, you know, predation. I think she sort of cherry-picked an example that, you know, that would uphold her thesis.
I definitely, when I was reading the excerpt, was thinking a lot, like, maybe, like you were, Noreen, what about bullying? And that's probably unfair because we haven't read the rest of the book, and she probably engages with that. I didn't grow up with social media or internet culture of any kind, but I think one thing that I sort of ignorantly assumed is that if you're a kid who's being bullied at school, that having a life and an internet life that more or less swim together, I mean, there's no differentiation between those two things at this point, it would sort of mean that you never had any respite from bullying because it would just constantly follow you around all the time. And I think in many cases that's true. But until I had read this excerpt and other things that Boyd had written before this podcast, I'd never considered the flip side of that, which is that having this online life also means that you have so many other outlets for support and community building and respite that you wouldn't have had otherwise, which is so obvious when I think about it, but I had never really properly considered it before. And then the other advantage, of course, is that you have, like, a digital map of bullying and abuse. You can have a paper trail from which, you know, parents and teachers and kids can learn from. I also like what she says about letting the kids take the lead and looking at kids' behavior online, not necessarily as, like, a set of warning flags of external danger of, like, people predating on your kids, but more as indicators of, like, internal stress and indicators of what they're lacking in their own lives. I thought that was a very reasonable and compassionate approach. And it's also very active. It's not a passive approach at all, even though obviously a big part of what she's saying is that parents should just step back and allow themselves the freedom to step back and not feel guilty about that.
Yeah, that's the part I liked a lot, too, is how at the end of her excerpt, you know, the point she's making basically is if kids are vulnerable in life, they're vulnerable online, and you'll be able to see that. Like, you can see, I mean, that was what was interesting about that story about Tess, is like you can, you know, instead of thinking of it as some perversion of their actual lives or a distorted lens, like actually look at it. It's a reflection of their actual lives, and you can actually see who's in danger instead of inventing all sorts of dangers. I will say, just to be fair, she does have a chapter about bullying. Is social media amplifying meanness and cruelty? This is something Emily Bazelon has written about a lot. But the book does, you know, talk about other subjects. We were just discussing her chapter on sexual predators. And Noreen, you're absolutely right. I do not worry a whit about my daughter. You know, my daughter would not, like, for one second take seriously, you know, some weirdo who wrote her or like meet him or anything like that. I'm, you know, 99% sure about that. But I do worry about all the other things, mm-hmm. like that she mm-hmm. has all these robust online relationships that she doesn't, you know, that she'd really rather on half of Saturday instead of calling a friend, just like email with her friends or, you know,
so
be on their various social media sites or whatever. And the thing that I do actually ask her about is bullying. Like, is anyone mean? Like, that's a question that I ask a lot. Like, who she would tell if she felt like someone was, you know, ostracizing someone online. Like, that is mm-hmm. something I more actively worry about.
Did you guys read the news story this week that apparently school dances are going the way of the dodo? Like, no one yeah. wants to go to school dances anymore because I guess they'd rather be online and interact in that way. And obviously, people have very complicated responses to school dances. You know, it's horrible if you don't get asked or whatever, or if you don't want to dance. But that just stunned me because, I don't know, it just seems like an important rite of adolescent passage. And to be able to be in a room with opposite sex or the same sex, whatever you're into, like, and sort of grapple with your emotions around that at age 15 seems really important.
I never
yeah,
went to
I
a school.
Sometimes I wonder if, like, so much of teenage awkwardness is avoided because everyone's on, because you are a presented person, you know?
Yeah.
But like then, you have a persona. Anyway, go ahead.
But then people's online personas often don't match up with their real life personas, and you have to live in the real world at some point. Wait, you never went to a high school dance?
No, said? I would have been ecstatic if there had been no dances in high school.
But that was like a choice you made about your
personality. Right.
It said
no,
something
it was
about
available.
You.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
No, it was totally available.
You rejected them and...
Like, yeah, I guess there's a difference between rejecting them or the dance rejecting you, depending. and you know, that being taken away from you as a choice.
Yeah.
You're right.
My
I went to my prom.
Been.
That's a school dance.
Yeah, that's a
school there you
dance.
Go.
Yeah. My daughter will never go to the school dance.
Why?
Why not?
I don't know. That's what, like, the more we're talking, the more I'm realizing that she has an incredibly robust online life that really has no relationship to her act. I don't know. She just wouldn't do it. Like, she just wouldn't. And in fact, she has, I shouldn't out her like this, but not only does she have, like, her own persona online, but she has all these invented personas that she's had going for years that she and her friends, like, communicate with that are so unbelievably, like, rich and have years of active life. I know this is weird, but, you know, this is, like, what she often does, you know? And
no,
they're
it's
all
not
different
weird.
Ages
it's just...
and, like, they have just, like, they're, like, novelistic characters that have been going on for years. And, like, that is much more interesting to her to do that than
that
to go
awesome.
To school dance.
Yeah, that's very creative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you live as an observer, I guess. That's just
totally.
Some people's personalities. Anyway, okay, I'm not going to worry about that school dance thing. She can go.
Sorry.
I did not have any fun at my prom. I went. I was, you know, I went when I was a sophomore. I went when I was a senior. And neither time was fun at the school dance. So. You're right. I'm with you, Jessica. It's not a great loss.
I took LSD at my prom.
You did?
Yeah.
Whoa, you just got so much cooler.
I wore a wedding gown with a 4-foot train, and I took LSD, and it was great.
Did you have a date?
I totally had a date. Yeah.
So you had fun.
I had a lot of fun at my prom. And for any of my high school teachers listening to this, I'm really sorry I took LSD at the prom.
Dude, now do people know? Was it very clear that the girl in the wedding dress was... Hi.
I think there were 4 of us, and we all took LSD with our dinner, and I think we just wandered out. It was, like, at this little, like, hotel complex, and we all wandered out to the pool afterwards, and we were just sitting in deck chairs staring at the pool. And I remember this kid named Frank kind of wandered out, and he had figured it out, and he just sort of watched us for a while, and then he went back.
I want a more dramatic ending, and then one of us drowned. And, you know.
No, we were fine. And actually, we walked like 2 miles home. because it was the 90s and you could do that.
Right.
It all comes full circle.
It all comes back around.
Reassuring the parents at home. Don't watch your kids. They'll just take LSD.
No, but that actually sounds like a pretty good way to spend a prom. I got drunk and then got too drunk and threw up and I didn't have fun. So that was my own fault. I should have just taken LSD. I had a much better time. Okay, let's move from LSD to Scarlett Johansson. Final topic. Scarlett Johansson is talking to the press, and the result is slightly odd. She's having a moment because she was the computer seductress in the critically acclaimed Her, and she has two movies coming out in April that show her extreme range. One is Captain America, The Winter Soldier, and the other is an indie movie called Under the Skin, which is a sci-fi horror movie where she apparently plays a mysterious woman who drives around Glasgow and picks up men for their meat. That's all I can say because I haven't seen it. She has also been involved in a couple of controversies, including the one surrounding Woody Allen. But we're mostly talking about her because of the truly odd profile by movie critic Anthony Lane, which ran in The New Yorker this week. It is irresistible to read a few lines from it just to give our listeners who have not yet read it a taste of what it's like. Okay. We can all read our favorite sentences if you have them written down, but I wrote down a couple here. Would it be construed as a trespass, therefore, to state that Johansson looks tellingly radiant in the flesh? Mind you, she rarely looks unradiant, so it's hard to say whether her condition has made a difference. Her condition. He means that her pregnancy, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Her condition. Okay. One more sentence. There was one scene at a champagne reception at a Spanish art gallery where Johansson was indeed gilded to behold. Can you say that? Gilded to behold? When you say them out loud, they sound even more weird. She seemed to be made from champagne. That's just weird.
At another point, he compares her to, he says, you know, her laugh is like dirty and straight up or something. I don't know. At another point, he compares her to a martini. Mm-hmm. He basically compares her to multiple alcoholic beverages.
Yeah.
The idea being she's intoxicated.
So we accept Scarlett Johansson, like her thing is that she's seductive, right? Like it's not, you know, this doesn't come from nowhere. She's a seductive person. That's would be the first thing that you notice about her in a movie. That's just often the character that she plays. So why does it turn like a really smart critic into this?
Well, can I offer a semi-defense?
Giddy up.
It's not of what he wrote, but it's more of an explanation, I think. So it was very clear to me in reading this article that he got like 12 minutes with her. And he even says in the article that it was like March 3rd or something, which is when she announced her pregnancy and he saw her a few days later. So he got like 12 minutes with her, like, you know, 2 weeks ago. He had to write this article really quickly. This is why people write bullshit celebrity profiles, because they get no access. What's usually different about The New Yorker is they get amazing access and they hang out with the person. I don't think he talked to a single other person other than Scarlett Johansson for this story. So it seemed like, if I can sort of like, as someone who works at a magazine, if I can guess what happened, they, at the last minute, offered Scarlett Johansson as a profile subject to The New Yorker. They thought it would be like a safe place to have her deal with her controversy. And The New Yorker, the fault is actually Anthony Lane's editors, who said yes. And they were like, well, let's turn it into a full feature and just write it. And so he ended up writing like the worst kind of Esquire profile. I mean, this kind of thing happens in Esquire all the time, but we sort of, you know, boys will be boys at Esquire, you know, think it's fine. But there was a cognitive dissonance of it coming in The New Yorker and like coming from a film critic who, you know, probably has, I think he's written sort of like things about women before that people have taken issue with. But anyway, but basically he had to blow it up to full feature length at the last minute with barely any materials. So he just was like, what do I like about the way Scarlett Johansson looks? Let me add 1,000 words about that. Call it a day.
And that's his critical mode, too. I mean, he's constantly talking about what people look like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's his MO. And I agree with you, Noreen. It was sort of like caught between one of those like drooling Esquire profiles and like a really standard issue broadsheet profile, like the kind you would read in The Guardian. Mm-hmm. You've got 20 minutes in a hotel room, go.
Mm-hmm.
But that, like you said, that didn't prevent him from calling secondary sources. Like, why didn't he talk to Jonathan Glazer, her director and the edge of the edgy indie Under the Skin, which sounds like a fantastic movie? Why didn't he talk to Robert Downey Jr. rather than quoting Iron Man? You know, I mean, there are a lot of things that he could do and tools in his toolbox that he could have used to get around this very strange situation. Because you're right. Usually in The New Yorker, when you're reading a celebrity profile, it's Tad Friend and he's spent a month on set and it's crazy access. And this was really anomalous. But it, at the same time, it very much read like an Anthony Lane review.
Yeah.
Like if he had simply read, if he had simply reviewed Under the Skin, it would have read a lot like this, I would imagine.
I'm totally okay. taking issue. Here's the problem. Like, I feel like this is it. That's the problem with this profile. It's like, what happens when somebody doesn't have any time? This is stream of consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
And the stream of consciousness is just, it's terrible. Like, as Katie Waldman points out, no way that The Guardian got more time with her. Like, if you have just empty space to write about whatever you want, like, you write all this bullshit instead of writing, you know, literally one stupid sentence about Woody Allen and another even stupider sentence about SodaStream, mm-hmm. both of which justify his inability to grapple with those subjects. Like, he just basically says she has nothing to say, which, as Katie Waldman points out, she doesn't have nothing to say because she did say things to this other magazine that chose to ask her a substantive question. It's almost like we get a real peek into his inner workings. I mean, I don't know him, but, you know, it just seems like he refused to take her seriously or to take any of the serious subjects seriously. And so you got a sense of how he thinks about these things.
Well, it seems, you know, like he's not a reporter. Like, that, if you're a reporter, you want to ask about SodaStream and you want to ask about Woody Allen. He instead, I bet he was like a little miffed at having to actually, you know, talk to someone in real life and like interact with her in three dimensions. That's not.
But don't you think he feels like he's having a good time? Like, musing about her unknowability and how he really writes about her like she's not a person.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, Katie Waldman writes about that in her piece on his piece. And I thought Katie was very astute in saying that this is less a portrait of Scarlett Johansson than it is of Anthony Lane. I mean, most Anthony Lane pieces end up being about Anthony Lane and Anthony Lane's own pleasure and delight in the contours of Anthony Lane's own mind and, you know, the puns and the irrelevant tangents thereof. I mean, the tangents that his editors allow him are just something. And you know, I don't think he composes so much as he just riffs. Like, he's like a stand-up comic. And I think he tends to be better writing on books than on film because he deigns to take books more seriously and he doesn't feel that obligation to find a double entendre in every line. And because he has that kind of nudge-nudge, wink-wink sensibility anyway, if a conventionally beautiful and sexy actress is placed in front of him, he's going to indulge all of his worst tendencies, and there's little anyone can do about it, it seems.
But if we found him more charming, some of my favorite writers are riffy. I'd have no particular affection for him, but I think if I find someone's riffs charming, I will go with them for a long time, particularly when they're... I mean, movies are an aesthetic experience. Like, the question of what... I mean, there are a lot of beautiful women in Hollywood. The question of what makes Scarlett Johansson, like... the quality about her is actually an interesting one. It would be really, really hard to do it, but you could write an essay on that that was a lot more interesting and thoughtful than this one was.
Absolutely.
I'm not like offended by him considering her beauty, I guess. Like, I think that's an important part of, you know, her arsenal.
Yeah. I mean, I think she's more interesting than Lane for all his interest in her gives her credit for. He alludes to this a little bit in that she has evaded two traps. One of the traps is as a conventionally beautiful, sexy woman, and the other trap is as a former child actor. Most child actors have some awkward in-between stage. Scarlett Johansson never did. A lot of actresses who are incredibly beautiful have that moment, like Halle Berry did in Monster's Ball or Charlize Theron did in Monster, where they decide to work against their looks and win an Oscar. And Scarlett Johansson hasn't done that yet either, and maybe she never will. And, you know, she's a very interesting subject in those regards. And he flicked at that a little bit, but he didn't really get right down to it. And I think that would have made an interesting piece.
I guess he
would have written such a smarter profile for her. In some sense, you wish he'd never met her at all. Like,
yeah,
if he had just written a cultural piece about Scarlett Johansson, what's interesting about her, what's different about her, you know, why we respect her, why we find her so sexy, even about her beauty. If there were just a riff he could do about her without having met her, I bet it would have been much better.
Mm.
Jessica, I don't think you saw 2007's Nanny Diaries, where she went brunette. So she really was going for the Oscar there, playing against her beauty. Anyway, streaming on Netflix.
Well, I guess in her, we don't see her at all. So maybe that was her monster.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Just
that's
her dirty martini of a voice.
Yep.
I think that was great. No, I mean, forget the dirty martini part. I do think he's a great writer, although maybe you're right. You don't find the riffs charming. I thought that was, you know, that was interesting just to have her voice and not her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just something that's just an interesting idea about sexiness and how we perceive it. And
yeah, I thought she was amazing in her. And
yeah.
I don't know if knowing what she looks like and seeing her in a lot of other roles informed or affected the way I interpreted her performance in her, or if she had given that performance as a total unknown, if I would have reacted to it the same way. It's interesting to think about.
They did the whole movie. So she was not originally the voice
right.
in her. It was some British
actress. Samantha Morton.
Yeah. And so then they redubbed the whole movie with Scarlett Johansson's voice. So Spike Jonze wanted something very specific. He knew that we would know Scarlett Johansson's voice. I think he wanted us to, on some level, be thinking of Scarlett Johansson when we heard that voice watching
the movie. And in this era when so many celebrities always do voiceovers and children's movies and play characters, it's, you know, kind of interesting to make the fact of their doing the voiceover a central idea in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I don't think I've recommended this before. I'm obsessed with Broad City. Have you guys been watching Broad City?
Oh, everyone's been recommending it to me. I still haven't gotten around to it.
You should get around to it. It's really, it's just so funny. It sounds like Girls when you describe it, because it's like two 20-something slackers in New York City who are women who, you know, just are living in Brooklyn and hanging out. But it's the tone is very different. It's just wickedly funny. They're like kind of stoners, and it's Alana Glazer and Abby something. Their names are escaping me, but they're very, very funny, and it's loose, and it also has a warmth to it, weirdly, that I don't think Girls always has. Girls kind of hates its characters. And Broad City, even though its plots are ridiculous and out of reality, feels sort of more real to me. Anyway, Broad City, Comedy Central, check it out.
Abby Jacobson.
Jacobson, yes.
Because you too, they feel real to you because you too have worked as like a naked.
I mean, yeah, the girl who has an office job just like sleeps at the desk. She, you know, brings a pillow into the bathroom to take a nap. This is Alana Glazer's character. She's very funny. And actually, Hannah, she looks like slightly like you. Like,
people have said that to me.
It's a compliment.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Not totally like you, but there's a profile or something.
That's cool. I'll take it. She does look kind of like me.
Do you watch Broad City?
My hair is not that frizzy anymore.
Your hair is much better. Wait, if you're listening, Alana Glazer, your hair is great too. Do you watch Broad City, Hannah?
I watched an early episode, and then I felt like people were kind of harsh on it in the reviews, and I let it slide. Like, I haven't watched it a lot just because, you know, it was just when House of Cards, like, there was just, you know, True Detective. Like, a lot of other things kind of floated into my TV world, but now that those, I will watch it. I mean, I didn't mind the first episode. I liked it. I thought it was pretty funny, so I will go back to it.
I like later episodes better. So if you only watch one episode, maybe give it one more chance.
I shall. So I will go next. I am really late to this recommendation. Everybody has told me for years to read this book called Parallel Lives, The Five Victorian Marriages. which is by Phyllis Rose. And like all of my smartest friends have told me this is their favorite book. They've read it forever. And, you know, a friend of mine who never has a book club had one book club, and it was about this book. So I finally got around to reading it. It's really, really, really fantastic book. It's just a study of these five Victorian marriages, all of which operate in completely different ways. But it winds up having so much wisdom about marriage in general and, you know, the kind of strange ways that people live their lives and tragedy turning into hope and all sorts of human nuggets. It's a really, really great book. So I highly recommend it. Jessica.
I want to recommend the work of another woman who was profiled in The New Yorker recently, but the profile got much less attention than Scarlett Johansson. And it was the profile of the writer and translator Lydia Davis, who writes these really wonderful and elliptical and strange short stories. They're often no longer than a sentence or even a sentence fragment. A lot of them read more like prose poems or little cones. And they tend to be really obsessed with grammar, and they parse the intricacies and idiosyncrasies of grammar to get at their meaning. She has a new book of stories called Can't and Won't, and it's not out just yet. It's out at the beginning of April. So I'm going to recommend getting started with Lydia Davis with an earlier short story collection called Samuel Johnson is Indignant. And that was actually the first Lydia Davis book I ever read myself. And I was totally hooked.
I love that book.
Yeah, I was totally hooked after that. So Lydia Davis, Samuel Johnson is Indignant. Check it out.
Sounds great. Well, thank you to Chris Wade for engineering and producing the podcast this week. We would like to thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. I remind you again, XXGabFest at Slate.com. Please go there and you can send us your recommendations, your comments on the show. For Noreen and Jessica, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.